The shippers, the oil industry, the fishing industry, they're all buzzing around the Arctic. Good morning and welcome to Talk of Alaska. I'm Steve Heimel. This is getting serious. Territorial claims are beginning to be made, and that is really just the beginning of it. The toll-free phone number here is 1-800-478-8255. That's 478-TALK. And Anchorage, a local call at 550-8422. We'll be talking about the Arctic, the pattern of the history of the Arctic, and what's next on Talk of Alaska statewide.
Today's program is underwritten in part by ConocoPhillips, Alaska's oil and gas company.
Well, here we are. I have a couple of guests joining me by telephone, and they are very, very highly qualified. And we're going to be taking two very different focuses on the Arctic, its past, and its future, because things are changing so fast now with the withdrawal of the sea ice. And suddenly it's gotten very serious, as I said in the introduction. Suddenly, nations are aware of the reality of other nations' presence in terms of how much armaments they have, how big their icebreakers are. And by the way, the Russians have the biggest icebreakers and the biggest fleet of them by far. I am joined by Richard Sale, who is the author of Scramble for the Arctic, who speaking to us from his home in Cheltenham, England. Hello, Richard. Welcome to Talk of Alaska.
Hello, thank you for inviting me.
And Richard is the author of Scramble for the Arctic. He's live by phone from England, where it's about 7 o'clock in the evening. And from Texas is Kenneth Dunton. He is professor at the University of Texas, but he also holds the contract for the Minerals Management Services COMEDA program. And I guess, Ken, I want to ask you to start with, what is the COMEDA program?
Well, good morning, Steve, from Texas. The COMEDA program is a program focused on the chemistry and the biology of the benthos, of the benthic environment, the bottom environment in the Northeast Chukchi Sea. The whole program is designed about collecting baseline measurements of chemical and biological resources in that area, with a focus on food web structure and the accumulation or baseline measurements of hydrocarbons and trace metals that are currently there in very small concentrations. But as I said, the baseline measurements are real important. And secondly, the program is focused on understanding, getting a better understanding of the seasonal, interannual, and long-term changes that occur in that system, so that we can distinguish, mainly so we can distinguish changes, natural changes maybe due to climate change versus anthropogenic impacts, perhaps from oil exploration and development.
Yeah. And, of course, the Minerals Management Service is in charge of the offshore leasing program. It's a federal program, and there was a record of $2.7 billion or something like that in bids that were put down for lease tracts in the Chukchi Sea. If you don't know where the Chukchi is, well, basically, it's part of the Arctic Ocean. It's the part that's above the Bering Straits. It extends in between the Russian Far East and Alaska, and it's separate from, let's say, the Beaufort Sea, which is like the other side of Barrow and over towards Barter Island and all that in there. And it's very different kind of waters, different kind of circulation. And a lot of this is explained by how deep or not deep it is, and we'll be getting into some of that. I think of significance is that this research probably would not be happening with this intensity if it were not for the prospect of oil and gas leasing there. And, of course, as a caller, you're welcome to talk about that, but that's not what Ken is here to talk about. He's here to talk about the science that they've been doing, because once you can spend the money on science, you start finding things out. And it was absolutely fascinating. In fact, I was just riveted sitting through the presentations of his team at the Marine Science Symposium that happened last week, because we are seeing a complex biology, a biological richness that I think people suspected was there, but now we're seeing the actual evidence of it. I mean, in terms of actually getting pictures of it and quantifying it. And that's why I asked Ken to be on the program. So, Ken, have I got it right? Is it very biologically rich in the Chukchi?
Yes, Steve, you have it very correct. The Chukchi Sea is actually, as you described it, is what we refer to as a gateway ocean between the North Pacific and the Arctic. A lot of materials funnel through the Bering Strait and get dumped, literally dumped in the Chukchi Sea, and that dumping of all that organic material feeds a very rich benthic environment, bottom environment that's characterized by a diverse group of invertebrate fauna, everything from sponges to ascidians to sea squirts, as we refer to them in a common name. And a lot of these organisms, of course, are food for upper trophic level organisms like gray whales, walrus in particular. So it's a relatively shallow shelf, so a lot of material ends up on the bottom from the water column, and what doesn't end up on the bottom gets funneled out onto the Arctic Ocean floor through Barrow Canyon or to the further west through the Central Channel into the Arctic Ocean. So it is a very productive system with quite a bit of life on the seabed.
Now, when you you're actually getting in there and getting samples and you're getting pictures, I recall seeing pictures of a whole lot of sand dollars, for instance, and a bunch of like worms and things like that. So, I mean, we're actually seeing critters here.
Yes, there's. You're absolutely correct. Probably the major groups that you noticed when you're watching these video clips that Lee Cooper and Jackie Greibmeier acquired were some of the major. Were obviously some of the most dominant players on the seabed. Those are pretty much dominated by echinoderms, which include brittle sea stars, sand dollars, basket stars, and then your crustaceans like hermit crabs and the snow crab and shrimp. Those are some of the major organisms there, and of course those are major prey. Those crustaceans are major prey for upper level trophic groups, like I said earlier, large fish and gray whales and walrus. So the polychaete worms, of course, those are key trophic organisms, a key prey for some of the crustaceans and the sea stars. So it's quite a complex food web. There's four or five trophic levels and very efficient, what we call linking between each of those trophic levels. There's very little wasted carbon in this environment. It all ends up in an animal somewhere, as opposed to being respired as CO2. It's a very efficient food web.
So, yeah, and this is, you know, what this has reminded me of is the tropical forest, really, where you also get that situation where there's not that much soil because everything is just completely cycling through.
Yes, there's a tremendous amount. That's one of the things that we're studying is the amount of respiration or organic decomposition uptake of oxygen on the seabed that gives us an idea of just how much carbon is being recycled on the seabed. And although there's organic carbon in the sediments, it's being recycled, we feel, fairly quickly. So it doesn't sit there very long before somebody takes it up and uses it as food. And then, of course, those consumers are then fed upon by other animals. We also have, besides the phytoplankton, the water column, and the advection or the transport of organic material from the Bering Sea and what have you, there's also quite a bit of in situ, what we call local production as well.
We're speaking with Ken Dunton, and he's in charge of a team of scientists who are examining the biology of the Chukchi Sea. And I want to stress to our listeners that what you're hearing on the radio right now is unpublished, brand new scientific observations. And one of the things that they're doing, of course, is getting, as he said, a baseline. And I can recall the Exxon Valdez oil spill in 1989, there was a whole squad of people from the National Park Service mostly, but anybody they could recruit, really, who ran out to try and get ahead of that spill because they didn't have baseline and all the public lands that were about to get smeared with oil, and they needed to go get it. You guys are going to have a baseline here, aren't you?
Yes, Steve, it's important to have some kind of idea of what the resources, what we have for resources in the Arctic Ocean, and particularly the Northeast Chukchi Sea. As you pointed out, that lease sale 193 in 2008 generated $2.6 billion in bids for that area. And so we know there's quite a bit of interest in exploration, at least exploration and so eventually development. So it's important to have an idea where the hot spots are, as we often refer to them biologically in that area. There are areas that are very, very rich, and some of one of those areas we feel is probably Hana Shoal, which is to the east of the Barrow. The west of the Barrow Canyon. There are other areas that seem to be dominated by very high diversity and biomass and numerical density of benthic animals, and of course those are areas that are probably the most popular for higher trophic level organisms.
Yeah. Well, I guess we should say your group is not the only bunch of scientists who are looking at this. There's a whole bunch of different ones, and one of them was looking at the chemistry, and when they would go and look at the sediments, for instance, off of Prudhoe Bay, they would find barium, and when they went to the Chukchi, they wouldn't find so much barium, and this is a pretty obvious one because barium is contained in drilling muds. And so these barium obviously got there from the oil fields, either from runoff or whatever. And so that's kind of what baseline is about, is if the environment were to be altered by a spill or any sort of event, then we would know what we would have something to compare it with.
Yes. The work on this team, there's actually eight members on this Comita science team, from five different universities, I believe, and we have been talking about the biology, but the chemistry is extremely important. The trace metals in the seawater and the sediments that John Treffery is doing, from FIT, then there's Roger Harvey from the University of Maryland, also looking at hydrocarbons in the sediments and looking for lipid biomarkers in some of the benthic animals. If we can identify a few animals, and that includes fish, that we can use for long-term sentinels, as we refer to them as. These are hydrophilic level organisms that if there were hydrocarbons or trace metals present, they would accumulate them in their tissues over time, especially the trace metals like, say, mercury. And by analyzing those organisms now, we have a baseline level of concentration that precedes any type of industrial activity in that area, and John Treffery and Roger Harvey have been very successful in doing that. And you're right, the levels of set of trace metals and hydrocarbons are very, very low in this area, very low.
So I understand also that there's been one species possibly identified as a kind of a sentinel, a mollusk, a kind of a whelk, I believe they call it.
Yes. The northern whelk, Neptunia heros, which gets quite large, the size of your fist or larger, is one of the organisms that we have identified as being a good candidate, mainly because Neptunia is present all the way through the Chukchi into the Beaufort Sea, and I've worked in the eastern Beaufort all the way to Demarcation Bay. I have found Neptunia, so it's fairly ubiquitous in the Arctic. It's an animal that we find in all depths of waters out to at least 50 meters, as well as right up onto into 5 meters of water, just 15 feet. And as I said, it's easy to collect fluids from for analysis, and already as we look at it, it seems to have a good solid level of trace metals that we can measure at a baseline concentration.
So, Ken Dunton, what is the schedule? In other words, it looks like some of that exploration could be taking place rather soon. You've got whatever scanty observations there were until these teams from, you know, that were funded by MMS money started going out. I think you've got, what, 1 or 2 years in? And what, will you be going out every year now or what?
Yes, we have. We're at this moment developing our crews for 2010. We'll be using perhaps a 200-foot research ship in the Chukchi this summer for 3 weeks. We'll be revisiting. We had 50 stations in the Chukchi Sea that we visited last summer, and we'll be revisiting many of those. We'll be Brenda Konar from University of Alaska Fairbanks will be trawling the benthos again and documenting the distribution and abundance of this very prolific epiphaunal group that we've noticed on the seabed. These are all the crabs and all the crustaceans and sea stars and the caudoderms that we've noticed. And others, Jackie Grebmeyer, myself, Lee Cooper, will be doing work with those benthic respiration measurements I mentioned earlier, and John Treffery and Roger Harvey will be looking at the chemistry. But the focus will be to visit some of the areas that we thought were seemed to have a lot of productivity based on our visits to these sites last summer. That will be the emphasis is to look at some of these really apparently really productive areas in the Northeast Chukchi. It's a huge area. It's a couple hundred nautical miles on each side, so it covers quite a huge area of seabed.
Now, basically, research is concentrating on the two lease areas, and the two lease areas are not all that far from one another on the map, but when you look at them undersea, I guess you find very different situations because the currents and the shallowness, because one starts coming up against that shoal you spoke of earlier, and the circulation essentially probably has some kind of eddy in it that creates different sorts of biology zones undersea there in the lease area.
Yes, the physics really drive the biology in this area. There are three major streams that enter the Chukchi Sea from the Pacific. There's the Alaskan coastal water that hugs the coastline, then there's the Bering Sea water or the Bering Shelf water and toward the center, and then on the western side there's the Anadyr water, the very rich Anadyr water that comes up from, of course, Anadyr Basin and moves along the west side of the basin of the Chukchi Shelf. And these water masses or these streams carry with them a large amount of material. They also are very different in terms of their hydrography. They have different temperature and salinity characteristics, and therefore there's different amounts of production associated with those temperature and salinity regimes. And those currents break off from small eddies that dump material onto the seabed. Those currents are important in terms of easing some of the boundary layer conditions that exist on the bottom to encourage that encourages production, and that's why we see such patchiness as we refer to it on the seabed in this area. There's areas that seem to be like they're right next to each other, but they're very different, and that's a function of not only of the physics, but it's also sometimes a function of some of the biology, just grazing, intense grazing by walrus, for instance, could lead to some of the differences that we're seeing in some areas. But yes, there's two focus areas that other biologists are working on these two lease areas that have been identified by the oil industry, and those areas are very different. But we're not really sure if there's really a gradient between those two. They're just simply different, and that could just be due to the heterogeneity that we have seen looking over the large scale in the Chukchi.
Yeah, I thank you, Ken Dunton, part of a team of scientists who are looking at the Chukchi Sea, largely because oil and gas leasing has taken place and oil and gas exploration is coming, and it turns out the biology is, I think, by anyone's measurement, rich and absolutely fascinating. And also, I think worthy of note is that there will be a transparency to this research. First off, anything that's done for the MMS goes out on the record, but also increasingly people can actually see like the mapping and stuff like this online. And it can get really pretty, you know, if you want to drill into this information, it's not a lot hard to get hold of it, is it, Ken?
No, and that's the one of the major components of our study is that we have a first class group of GIS geographers that do a lot of the geographic information system mapping for us. They put everything, they take all this data and they lay it on maps of the area, bathymetric maps, so that you can see the trends that we see in the data. Any person can come along and look at these and see the same kinds of relationships that we see among the physics and the biology. And all that information will be soon on a website that we're putting together here at the University of Texas, Austin. So that will be readily available here, hopefully, in the next month or so.
Okay, it's wonderful. Yeah, I got a soft spot in my heart for GIS and GIS people. Thank you, Ken Dutton. If you could stay with us, I want to move to our next guest here, and he may have a few questions of you. Richard Sale, as we know, is a very curious person. He's an explorer. He is the author of To the Ends of the Earth, The History of Polar Exploration, 2003 Outdoor Book of the Year in the United Kingdom. He's the author of the very comprehensive and gorgeous The Arctic, The Complete Story, and now the author of The Scramble for the Arctic with Eugene Potapov. Yes. The Scramble for the Arctic, Ownership, Exploration, and Conflict in the Far North. Richard, welcome to Talk of Alaska.
Thank you very much.
Well, now, why would you write, when you just got done writing The Complete Story of the Arctic, why'd you have to write this book with this picture of a scary Russian icebreaker on the cover of it?
Well, The Complete Arctic was actually my celebration of everything that I love about the area and about its wildlife. Scramble for the Arctic was, in a sense, my fears for what might happen to it in the next couple of decades.
You know, it is, I will have to say, an extremely densely packed history book with an almost Germanic overview, in the sense that it appears that what you've done here, and maybe you don't see it this way, is tried to get the biggest of big pictures of the Arctic, going back to way before prehistory and going as far as you can into the present and guessing a little bit about the future.
Oh, guessing definitely. I mean, let's not be under any illusion about that. I mean, what I've done is, I mean, it's a Confucius comment that in order to understand the future, you have to understand the past. And so I went back into the past in order to look at the way in which, excuse me, ownership developed and exploitation developed in the Arctic, and what we might learn about that. And I'm afraid that what it seems to me is what we're learning about it. Is it in the same way that we exploited the Arctic's wildlife for fur and for whale and the whales as well? We are now likely to do again. And I think it's, in a sense, it's in the nature of human beings, if you like. I don't think there's anything particularly special about the Arctic in terms of the way that we intend to exploit it. It's just that my own love of the area makes me fearful for its future.
So tell me a little bit more about your love for the area. You're an explorer, so.
Yes, I'm a physicist. I'm not a. I imagine that Ken is a zoologist. I'm a physicist by profession, and started out first off as a glaciologist studying glaciers, mostly in Europe. Not surprisingly, that's where I live. But then a few years ago, actually having traveled initially to the Arctic. Really, because I was just interested in, well, I mean, to be absolutely frank, the first time I went, it was to climb one of its mountains. And I just fell in love with the scenery and also with the wildlife. And then a few years ago, decided that I wanted to give up full-time science in order to become a writer and a photographer so that I could spend more time traveling the Arctic. And it's now my intention, in fact, to become, like Ken, a zoologist. So I'm just starting out on that trail.
So if perhaps you have some questions for Ken Dutton. This is all brand new science that's coming out about the Chukchi. I don't know how much you might know specifically about the Chukchi.
I don't know very much specifically about the work that Ken's doing. In fact, one of the questions which was arising in my mind whilst he was talking was whether or not he's actually doing this this work under the ice or just under clear water.
Oh, it's an excellent question because there has been icebreaker work, but I don't think on this voyage. Right, Ken?
Oh, that's correct. This is all open water work.
This is
not working to connect under the ice.
What do you find actually underneath the ice itself?
Okay, well, Richard, that takes us back to another one of my projects in the Beaufort Sea. I've done a lot of diving in the Beaufort Sea under the ice during the nine-month ice-covered period, and actually, there's a lot going on underneath the ice and during the ice-covered period from November through May. It's unfortunate that the logistic costs of working in the Arctic during the winter months is so high because the Arctic doesn't shut down after the ice forms. In contrast, it is extremely active under the ice. It's one, actually, I do a lot of measurements of kelp, macroalgal seaweed growth, and these plants complete most of their growth under the ice during the winter time. They take up most of their nutrients in the winter time. A lot of the fishes are spawning during the winter period along with the invertebrates. There's egg cases being laid all over the bottom and on the plants. It's actually a very, very important period, but yet it's a period of time that we just have not been able to spend a lot of work looking at these processes and mechanisms and some of the activities going on with the fauna.
Were you one of Peter McRoy's graduate students, Ken?
No. Peter McRoy was a committee member, but he was not my advisor. My advisor was Don Schell at the University of Alaska Fairbanks.
Oh, all right. Well, I remember Pete telling me that, you know, the real thing that's going on is underneath all this ice. He said there's a lot more biology than people realize on the underside of the ice, and I guess you're confirming that.
Yes, both. I was on the seabed, but yes, working underside of the ice as well. We crawl up, dive up, work underneath the ice itself and look at the ice algae and all the fauna associated with the ice algae, including small fish. It's what we often refer to as the ice algal subsidy to the marine environment. There's quite a bit of production in the ice that feeds its own trophic group or a set of animals, and a lot of that production ends up on the bottom and actually supplements production during the dark winter, ice-covered winter months. So it's pretty important.
Mm. Any other questions for our other guests there, Richard Sale?
No, I think the general question is what will happen when the ice disappears? That's mostly what concerns me, I think. We're going to lose an absolutely fascinating ecology. And from the sound of what Ken's saying, I mean, the underside of the ice is important. The under-ice sea is important. All of that will disappear. And potentially we're also going to lose iconic animals like the polar bear. And I do get slightly concerned that we're actually moving in now in order to explore, to try and get oil and gas out from that area, knowing that one of the byproducts of that exploration is going to be a decrease in the ice mass.
Well, that is interesting. We actually had a Norm provided that exact same comment from email. I'm listening to your show on the slow disappearing Arctic ice. Sad that as available areas are exposed, they have to be scrambled for exploitation. Climate change caused the disappearance of the ice from burning of fossil fuels. The fox opened the door to the hen house. Why let the wolves in? That from Norm. So, yeah, it's going to get political from this point on, Ken, and I'll give you the opportunity to opt out here at the half-hour mark if you wish, because I know I only asked you here to talk about this brand-new science, and I don't necessarily want to involve you in a political debate, unless you want to hang around.
I'll be happy to hang around for a few more minutes, Steve. No problem. I enjoy the conversation.
Okay, great. Then we will be back when Talk of Alaska continues.
Talk of Alaska comes to you from APRN, the Alaska Public Radio Network, and is made possible with support from Alaska Communication Systems, connecting your business and employees to the world through their high-capacity data network, bandwidth speeds up to 1,000 megabits per second, acsalaska.com.
Our telephone number is 1-800-478-8255. If you'd like to join our conversation, 1-800-478-TALK. Statewide, a local call in Anchorage of 550-8422. And the email is available, as you just heard, talk@aprn.org. What we've got so far is we've been talking mostly to Ken Dunton. He is a University of Texas professor leading a research team that's looking at the Chukchi Sea and finding some amazing, rich, diverse biology. And Ken says that much of what they have found out is being inputted into GIS software and is going to be available on a website set up by the University of Texas in the not-too-distant future. This is being funded by the Minerals Management Service. This was an area where oil and gas leasing brought in a record dollar amount, although if you take the inflation out of it, it wasn't really quite as big as at least one of the past ones. But nonetheless, an enormous amount of money has been laid down by the industry because they think there's oil and gas there. And Mr. Dunton is not here to talk about whether or not we should get that oil and gas. He's here to talk about the biology that his team is finding. But here and willing to talk about that is Richard Sale, the author of Scramble for the Arctic, joins us by telephone from England. And Scramble for the Arctic is a very comprehensive. If you want a one-volume piece that's less than an inch thick that tells you everything about the Arctic, this is the one for you, the Scramble for the Arctic. It's a British book, but it's also published in the United States. And Richard Sale is our guest here on Talk of Alaska. He's known as the author of The Arctic, The Complete Story. This is a gorgeous piece of work. This one is co-written as that one was, I believe, with Eugene Potapov.
No, The Complete Arctic was all my own.
And you took the pictures?
I don't have to share any of the sins of that one, I'm afraid.
And you took the pictures in that one too?
I took the pictures, but some of those the pictures in The Complete Arctic were taken by a Norwegian who I travel with on occasions.
I see.
So I think about two-thirds of the shots were mine, about one-third of his, but all the text of that one was mine. This one is with this ornithologist friend of mine, Eugene Potapov. He's Russian, obviously, but he's now, at the moment, he's a professor in a college in Pennsylvania.
Now, did you find any exceptions to this notion you have that mankind inevitably exploits the Arctic? In all of history, in all of prehistory, you go back to the very earliest presence of human beings, and it seems like it's almost every time.
Yes, I think so. I think it's a general trend of human beings. In fact, I mean, one of the things about Inuit civilization in North America, but also about the native peoples of the Eurasian Arctic as well, is that the idea that they lived in harmony with nature can be overstated. That's a somewhat romantic view. The Inuit did, in a sense, live in harmony with nature, but that's basically because they didn't have guns and outboard motors. As soon as they got guns and outboard motors, they did exactly the same things as the Plains Indians did in the southern states of the USA. As soon as they had guns and horses, they decimated the buffalo. They were very difficult and dangerous to kill on a one-off basis when all you had was a bow and arrow and a pair of moccasins, And that was exactly the same was the case with the Inuit in the Arctic. If all you had was a harpoon and a bow and arrow, then you only killed one animal, if you were lucky, every few days. But that romantic view, I don't think, holds terribly well. I think that had they had the technology, they would have exploited the Arctic, perhaps not quite as viciously as the Europeans did when they arrived, but certainly they would have killed in greater numbers.
Well, let me ask you this. Have you ever been to Barrow for Nalakatuck?
I've been to Barrow, but not for Nalakatuck.
Well, I will have to say that, this is kind of an interesting situation. I don't know as people in Barrow, well, I know a lot of them would disagree with you about how good a stewards they might be. It's still their belief that the whale has to give itself up, and they don't speak of the whale. Obviously, whaling is tightly regulated. It's under a quota system under the International Whaling Commission, for better or for worse. And and this subsistence whaling does form still a total cornerstone of the culture for the people along the Arctic slope.
Absolutely, and the only reason that there's a quota on bullheads for those people at the moment because of the enormous exploitation of the bullheads by the Europeans.
Yeah, so in a sense,
wipe the animals out.
Yeah, so in a sense, for better or for worse, a treaty system worked here, I guess is my point.
Yes, that's right. And it works on both sides of the Bering Sea as well, in fact, because the Russians also have a quota on bowheads. And it works reasonably well. There are times when the native Alaskans have complained about the size of their quota, but I think there will always be those sorts of arguments as to exactly how big a whale population is because it's a vast ocean and they're difficult to spot.
Well,
I think my query would be whether or not, I mean, I'm absolutely with you that in fact the Inuit, at least 100 years ago certainly, and even many Inuit today, certainly the elders, still have this shamanistic view of nature and still are at one with nature in a sense. My feeling is though that had they had proper bigger ships and harpoon guns, explosive harpoon guns, we would have seen a big increase in the population of Inuit in northern Alaska as they were able to kill more whales.
Yeah. And of course, that's just kind of almost a biology question, although I'll probably get in trouble for saying that. 1-800-478-8255. I wanted to get around to this business of treaties, however. And that is, there is the Law of the Sea Treaty. Everybody is signed on to it except the United States. That's kind of weird.
Yes, and that's still the case. In fact, when the book was published, right up until the time that we were printing, I was still watching the website to see whether or not the United States were going to ratify the treaty, and they had not on the day when we had to print.
Yes, and that's still the case, and it hasn't been the case now.
In fact, that's correct. Yes.
But the votes actually might be there in the Senate now, but it's just kind of hard to tell what's happening with the political winds. Anyway, would you from your point of view, your internationalist point of view, would you? I would assume that you would think that ratification of the Law of the Sea Treaty would be a very good thing.
Yes, I would. Yes.
It's my understanding that this is the means by which assertions can be made to claims on the subsea of the Arctic.
Yeah, well, it's one of the ways in which the claims will be made. The problem is that the law of the sea is not terribly good at defining ice rather than open water, and is not terribly good when it comes to ownership of the high sea. And the difficulty will always be when you have countries like Russia and Canada who are making sector claims to the Arctic, and so they're drawing lines all the way up to the North Pole and saying everything within this sector I own, that's always going to create a difficulty for the law of the sea, simply because it goes over ice, which is not explicitly mentioned in the law, and simply because it goes over what other nations consider to be high sea.
Yes. Well, as if you're still with us, Ken, you were probably there when Larry Mayer gave his presentation on the cartography, the undersea cartography of the Chukchi.
Yes. Well, I caught part of it because I was interrupted, unfortunately. Partway through it, but yes, it was. I heard it was excellent, and but I unfortunately missed pieces of it.
Yeah. Well, Richard Sale, I will tell you. Basically, this is the guy that's doing the mapping for the United States. And what he's found is that the shelf goes way further. The U.S.-Russia shelf, and the U.S. and Russia already have established a line to demarcate their border. But that common shelf underneath both of them goes much further out than anybody thought. Indeed, within, 15 degrees perhaps of... maybe more like 12 degrees of the pole itself. In other words, they've got the U.S. has, if it ever ratifies the Law of the Sea Treaty, apparently it has its assertion to go along with Canada's and Denmark's and Russia's.
Right. Well, that gives them another good reason for ratification, I guess.
Yeah, I think over time it probably does, but right now it's all very undecided. Policy-wise in the United States, we have this oil and gas leasing and how that's going to be conducted. Let's bring Roberta into the program at this point, especially seeing as how we still have Ken Denton with us. Roberta, welcome to Talk of Alaska.
Good morning.
And you're calling from Homer, I see.
I'm in Homer. And I've got a couple thoughts. And one of them is I'm wondering if either of your guests have been working hand in hand with the oil companies, because that seems like the only way we're going to be able to make a difference. And it seems like they're going to have to be the leaders in the renewable alternative clean energy, because they have the money and the power to make the change. And I keep talking about my four E's, and I'm trying to get this worldwide, is the balance, and you use the four E's, economy, environment, energy, and ethics, as a template to make all decisions for all projects everywhere. And so I'm just wondering if they are working with the oil companies in their endeavors.
All right. Well, let me say tactically that this is an early point in the political situation. And so right now it's to the advantage of Shell, and they know it very well, to do everything they can for the scientists. And I guess you would say, Ken Denton, they really are being very cooperative, aren't they?
Yes. We've had tremendous, very good cooperation with respect to ship logistics. It's a major challenge to obtain a ship to work in this area, because there is so much going on. And Shell, in concert with ConocoPhillips, although they need the ships, they've been willing to cut loose the oceanographic vessels. Oceanographic vessels.
We lost Roberta. Okay. I'll pay. Thank you very much. Let's go to Richard Sale with a little bit more on this. In general, these oil giants they've been able to get away pretty much with greenwashing so far, wouldn't you say? I mean, they don't have to put a whole lot of substance behind their showing themselves to be looking towards a future of phasing out fossil fuels.
That certainly seems to be the case, from my view here in the UK. And just quickly, in answer to your caller, I am completely independent of all oil and gas companies. In fact, I'm completely independent of anybody. I live entirely on the proceeds that I get from books and photographs. But yes, I would agree that there is considerable evidence, on the British side, there appears to be that we have papers which are produced which suggest that at the same time as oil and gas industries are actually funding fundamental research, very good fundamental research, they are also funding greenwash organizations which are actually denying any anthropogenic input to climate change.
Yeah, okay. We call that AstroTurf. You're getting confused here. We got different slang. Yeah, greenwashing would be a dirty corporation seeking to make itself look clean by advertising as if it were clean. And astroturfing.
They're doing that in spades in Britain.
Yeah, but I mean, BP did that, but then it turned out that they had some money problems, and all of a sudden, all that kind of went to the back burner.
Yeah, that's right. I mean, that's the first thing which goes. The problem always seems to be to me that you cannot serve two masters. And I mean, primarily these companies actually exist in order to pay dividends to their shareholders and make profits.
Yes, and we've gone through the peak oil debate here on this program several times. And the thinking there is that there comes a certain point when it actually is not so profitable to be investing in finding new reserves, and you do want to find new reserves. They do have to think some 30 years ahead. So, yes, it is possible that there could be some leadership, Roberta, as time goes on. The telephone number is 1-800-478-8255. In Anchorage, a local call at 550-8422. Our email is talk@aprn.org. And we're talking about the Arctic as a frontier, because it very much is a frontier. We are on the wild frontier right now, as Talk of Alaska continues.
Talk of Alaska comes to you from APRN, the Alaska Public Radio Network, and is made possible with support from BP, teaming up with Alaskans since statehood, and together looking toward a bright future.
It was years ago when I was reading a report from the Minerals Management Service, and it said, you know, we can't have oil leasing in both the Beaufort and the Chukchi Seas because there's an endangered species that's in the Chukchi rooting around in those sediments getting stuff to eat. And that was the gray whale. Now we're seeing more and more gray whales getting all the way up into the Beaufort. There was a notorious episode some years ago, of course, that got all sorts of headlines, but just routinely, and even orcas are now being seen up there. And so clearly things are changing. The ecosystem is changing. And for some reason now, even though there's an endangered species that's rooting around out there, as a matter of fact, several of them, and probably more coming, more designations coming, we're still leasing for oil and gas. Out in the Chukchi Sea. We've done it. They have the leases, and now they want to do the exploration. We're talking with Richard Sale, author of The Scramble for the Arctic. And Richard, is this a pattern that we're seeing elsewhere? What we saw just yesterday was that a Norwegian company has now bought into State Oil, or Statoil, has now bought into ConocoPhillips leases in the Chukchi. They bought a 25% interest in that.
Yes, that doesn't surprise me, because they're already exploring in the Barents Sea as well, and are working with the Russians in the Barents Sea, and are producing some of the biggest, they're planning one of the biggest gas terminals in the world right in the Barents Sea.
Do you view it as inevitable?
That's not a surprise at all.
Do you just view it as inevitable that just as we had our, despite all of the precautions and the engineering and so forth, eventually the Exxon Valdez ran into a reef? Do you just think there's going to be a catastrophe in the Arctic at some point, and maybe the...
Well, I think if you were a betting man, I mean, that's the way that you put your money. The fact is that these accidents do occur, and although Exxon Valdez was an enormously big one, the number of oil spills which there have been on the North Slope side runs into thousands, yeah. And some of them are preventable, and they are not prevented, because in the last analysis, it's all down to human beings, and we're fallible.
So here you are with this book, The Scramble for the Arctic. It's, I guess, what do you call it? Maybe it's kind of a love story, really, ultimately.
The real love story was the previous book. This is the sort of, please don't take my love from me story. but yes, you're right. I mean, it's a love story, really. It says this is one of the great places on Earth, a fantastic ecosystem full of extraordinary animals that can actually survive in conditions which human beings cannot survive in for more than a few minutes without taking enormous precautions. And we're endangering all of them. We're endangering the entire ecosystem.
I will tell you what, you know, in my years up here has been coming home to me more and more, and that is the just the true amazingness of the raw geography of it. You take a place like Nares Strait, for instance, and the strange winds and currents that they have through there, the things that happen in the sky up above that, the enormous masses of seabirds, millions of shearwaters have been seen diving into the waters of the Bering Sea north of the Aleutian Island. Millions, millions of birds. A person can look at millions of birds. I've seen maybe 30,000 at most. I mean, there are things that are just totally amazing about the Arctic.
Yes, there are, and I mean there are animals. I mean, the world is covered with animals, obviously, which are extraordinary in their own way. But things like the narwhal, things like the bowhead, the beluga whale, are just completely extraordinary. The ability to actually survive in ice-covered waters, to navigate through solid ice effectively, to go underneath the ice and come up further on, having detected openings in which to breathe. These animals really are extraordinary.
And Ken Dunton, the biologist at University of Texas, I imagine that for you personally to actually get out there and do this amount of field work with this amount of, what would you call it? You can't call it ground truthing, subsea truthing maybe, must be just personally very, very interesting.
Yes, it is, Steve. Oh, I've been doing it for 34 years or something, there's never a year that goes by that something doesn't completely floor you and fascinate you. It's an incredibly interesting environment, and because it's changing, it's particularly over the last few years, it's extremely interesting as a scientist to be documenting these changes and to try to attempt to guess what's going to happen next, because it's a very complex system, but it's also changing very quickly, and we just don't have a good handle yet just what direction we're going to go in for sure, but it's a fascinating place to work, and that includes from the Chukchi all around to the Beaufort, and I've worked in the Canadian Arctic, the Norwegian Arctic, and the Russian Arctic, and they're all fascinating places.
I think even like the prehistory is really a frontier. You know, I was talking to some researchers, mostly Russian, and their picture of the glaciation is really different than what the maps show. and there's pretty solid evidence for this. There's scouring out there in the Chukchi that still nobody's quite got the explanation for instance. And it goes on.
Seabed scouring, you mean?
Yes. Quite deep.
Yeah. Well, there are these ice movements, EVOs and other and the big gyres which actually bring the ice around, which are still pretty complex. I mean, I'm not sure that we understand the physics of it quite yet.
No. Well, one thing we do understand is that there's less multi-year ice, particularly in the Chukchi, and this is resulting in different circulation, at least on the surface, and that was real clear from the science we saw last week. That the Polynya is, you know what a Polynya is, of course.
Yeah.
And probably I need to tell the listeners this essentially is kind of a whirlpool, so it acts as kind of a gathering spot for a very rich biology, and it can even exist in the wintertime, and it's just not forming up the way it once did up there in the Chukchi, just because the ice is not going deep enough to hang up on some of the shoaly areas. And on it goes.
Also because the weather patterns are changing as well, because some of the Polynyas are actually held open by wind changes as well as ice movements. And as the weather patterns change, so that affects their formation and duration.
Carl joins the program from Homer. Welcome to Talk of Alaska, Carl.
Well, thank you. This is a great, fascinating program. I wanted to mention that Roberta might want to add another to her list, and that would be education. Here in Alaska, we are the only state that has ice, and Colorado has more science vessels than Alaska does. It's kind of preposterous. And why don't we bring the poles to the classroom? We can't bring the students to the classroom as well, but other countries build polar expedition vessels to go up and study the ice, freeze in for years at a time sometimes, to do this observation, get the eyes and the feet and the scientists on board. And now with the technology we have, it's a simple matter to uplink that to the classrooms, to have our students operate ROVs from the classroom to investigate underneath the ice. It would be a wonderful science and technology program that would benefit Alaska.
You need to, Carl, you need to get in, Carl, you need to get in touch with the Sea Life Center, because that very program is actually being started by Michelle Ridgway.
That's fantastic. This is something I've been advocating for a long time, but why don't we build the vessels in Alaska, create the industry here, manufacture, get some stimulus money, and have a fleet of fuel-efficient vessels that demonstrate renewable energy as we go about getting on top of our ocean ecosystems and science.
It sounds like a great idea to me. I don't think anybody that either of my guests have any objection to something like that at all.
I certainly wouldn't have any objection to that at all. I think education, much as your caller is saying, education is actually at the forefront, really.
And also, I think as our computer power gets better and our broadband gets better, we do have a chance of really having some really cool stuff to get on the web about to connect people better with that biology, maybe. Don't you think, Ken Dutton?
Yes. In fact, I'm so glad you mentioned the E for education. I was going to mention that as well. I have a $2 million GK-12 program for the National Science Foundation, which basically puts grad students in classrooms with teachers in science classrooms. And that's the whole idea, is to bring science, bring live science into the classroom. I've had teachers at Katovic, the village Katovic there at Botter Island, and we're actually looking to do some more of that, where I've had them on our boat there in on Botter Island, and I couldn't be more of a believer in education and bringing science alive for the public, especially school students throughout the country in particular, so they have a better appreciation, understanding what goes on at the in the Arctic region.
All right. Well, I want to thank you very much for being with us, Ken Dutton. You got the last word, Richard Sale, so you can pitch away here. The book is entitled The Scramble for the Arctic.
My last word would be, it's a fantastic place, and let's try hard not to lose it.
Well, are you, you want to go back?
Go back?
Yes,
why?
Back to the Arctic.
Oh, so do I. Oh, yes. Yeah, I mean, it's a real problem if you live in Britain. Do you actually get on a plane and do your own part to actually increasing the CO2, or do you go back to a place which you find absolutely fascinating and wonderful? And I'm going less often now, but I'm still going.
All right. I want to thank you so much for staying up tonight to talk to us from England, Richard Sale.
That's fine.
All right. Author of The Scramble for the Arctic. We also had Ken Dutton from the University of Texas in Austin. BD Trantina on the phones. And Dave Waldron on the controls. Pat Yak on the phones. I'm Steve Heimel. Thanks for listening.
Talk of Alaska is made possible by this member station of the Alaska Public Radio Network, by Tel Alaska, a telecommunications company proud to support public broadcasting, sharing the spirit of communications across the Great Land. Voice data and Wi-Fi technologies at Tel Alaska, on the web at telalaska.com. Views expressed on this program are those of the participants and not necessarily those of APRN, this station, or its underwriters. Today's program is available online at aprn.org. CD copies are available by calling 550-8400.
This is APRN, the Alaska Public Radio Network.